KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this morning's opening hour of Forum, we take on the federal budget proposed earlier this week by President Bush and his administration, and we'll discuss who benefits, who doesn't, and what it all means and will mean. Forum is next with a panel and your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. I've been out ill a couple of days, but I just want to say before we begin that we are very sad about the passing of Molly Ivins, who was a friend of the program's and who will indeed be missed. Earlier this week, President Bush handed over to Congress his $2.1 trillion fiscal budget for the year 2008 and the budget year beginning the 1st of October. The proposal calls for a balanced budget by the year 2012, and it also calls for keeping taxes low. The New York Times describes the budget as having few concessions and, quote, a defiant statement of principles that the president presumably has championed for years now. Partisan battles loom, and analysts say the winners in this budget presently, in the way it's formed, are the Departments of Defense, Veterans Affairs, and Departments of State, Labor, and the Interior, while the losers include the EPA, Amtrak, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Labor Department's Bureau of International Labor Affairs, the Department of Labor, and the Office of Disability Employment Policy. In this hour, we want to focus on the proposed federal budget, and we're joined by, first, Annalise Anderson, Senior Research Fellow with the Hoover Institution and former Associate Director for Economics and Government with the U.S. Office of Management and Budget, joins us by phone from Portola Valley. Welcome, Annalise Anderson.
Hello, Michael.
Hi, glad to have you. Also want to welcome and say hello to Brad DeLong, also joining us this morning, professor of economics at UC Berkeley, also research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research, and was Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy between 1993 and 1995. And good morning, Brad DeLong.
Good morning.
Also say good morning to Deborah Solomon, who is a reporter with the Wall Street Journal, who has been covering the budget and who we're going to talk to kind of right at the top to get a repertorial view. Deborah Solomon, welcome.
Hey.
Hi. Let me begin just by asking you, a lot of the focus is on the $245 billion for the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, but many of the critics are saying the White House hasn't really made any serious attempts to pencil in post-2008 war costs.
Well, that's true. What they've done is for 2009, they give a plug number of about $50 billion, which is what they had been doing all along until earlier this year, or well, last year, actually, they started to try and assess the costs more clearly, although they were always, they wound up underestimating anyway. So, you know, 2009, we see a plug for $50 billion, but nothing beyond that.
We also see a shrinking of the deficit and surplus by 2012. This is based on some pretty, shall we say, optimistic economic forecasting, or at least maybe some say pipe dreaming?
Well, I mean, there are several things going on. One is that the administration is projecting some pretty strong revenue growth, about more than 5% annual growth each year through 2012. I mean, some folks argue that that's optimistic. House Budget Committee Chairman is saying that it's, you know, it's overestimating. Others say it's within the historical norms. At the same time, the White House traditionally doesn't factor in the cost of a fix to a tax that has basically started to ensnare a lot of the middle class. It's called the alternative minimum tax. And each year, Congress does a one-year patch that kind of helps people not pay it. It was intended for the rich, but it was never indexed for inflation, so a lot of people wound up paying it who would wind up paying it who it wasn't intended for. But they don't factor that in, and that's a big cost. It's about, I don't know, I think $1 trillion over 10 years that would cost the government. So if you don't factor that in, you know, your deficit projections look more rosy because you're assuming you're getting that revenue even though you know you're not going to.
And this would make the president's first term tax cuts permanent.
Yes. I mean, his budget always assumes that the tax cuts are made permanent.
And we're also getting a good deal of response, at least from the Democratic side, about health care. What we're seeing essentially is the president pretty much putting forward what he stated in the State of the Union address, or what he proposed in the State of the Union address, and Democrats, of course, are in strong opposition and say that this would really encourage businesses to drop coverage, and it would make Medicare reimbursements and the biggest Medicare cuts since he's been in office.
Right. Well, there's two things going on. One is that they have this new proposal to help more of the uninsured get health care. They're going to change the tax code so that people who buy health insurance on the open market or through their employer could get a tax deduction. They're also going to make employer sponsored health care taxable for the first time. So if you get health insurance from NPR, they'll tax you and then you'll get a deduction. So you can be a winner or a loser depending on how much your coverage is worth. And they're also trying to slow the growth rate of Medicare, which is obviously one of the biggest things in the budget. I mean, it's a drag on the budget now, and you know, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, it's going to swamp the federal budget. So they're trying to slow the growth rate there by trimming back some cuts. And yeah, the Democrats are not happy about any of this. Although, you know, they do agree that there needs to be something done to help the uninsured. They want tax credits instead of tax deductions. So there might be something done. It probably won't be exactly what Bush proposed, but we'll probably see a lot of health care talk over the next 2 years.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about health care. Again, from your position reporting on this budget, Harry Reid of the Democrats says the budget favors oil and gas industry, but it erodes health coverage for seniors, children, and this is going to be devastating to them as well as to the disabled. Is that fairly accurate, or is that partisan politics?
I mean, partly the budget is a game. I mean, you know, the president submits a budget with a lot of things he knows that Congress is never going to go for. I mean, every year he puts in cuts to programs, you know, social service programs that he knows Congress will never let expire. This helps him show, you know, better deficit numbers. But also knows that Congress is going to put the money back in for things like low-income heating, you know, assistance, things like social service block grants. So part of it is that, you know, there's things in here. Yes, there is this state children's health insurance program that is going to have basically be underfunded in terms of the enrollment levels. And so there's a lot of criticism of that proposal. It comes up for reauthorization, and most people expect that Congress will wind up funding it, you know, much more fully than the Bush administration has asked.
We're talking to Deborah Solomon of the Wall Street Journal. Formerly, I'd add, of the San Francisco Chronicle, right?
Yes.
Just an overall picture before we go to Annalise Anderson and Brad DeLong, in the sense that the president's pretty much saying, you know, this is what I've always stood for and this is what I'm going to continue to stand for. He's going to have some real political battles on his hands, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is his, you know, this budget comes when the power has changed in Washington and Democrats are controlling the hearings. You know, they're controlling what gets to the floor. And, you know, just from the get-go, they were screaming about the budget. You know, yesterday they had Rob Portman, the head of OMB, and Treasury Secretary Paulson up on the Hill testifying, and every question was pretty aggressive. You know, why did you do this? How can you cut back these programs? Why aren't you doing more to deal with entitlement reform? So I think you're going to see over the next 2 years some pretty big flashpoints on things like education, healthcare, environment, energy. But the Democrats also have a problem because they need to pay for the stuff they want to do, and they want to balance the budget as well. They've got a huge military cost, which they can't, you know, you can't start cutting. They don't want to start cutting defense because, you know, we're at war. So they're going to have a big battle on their hands and also some tough decisions to make.
They're also going to have to face re-election in many cases, and that's going to put perhaps a damper. But Charles Rangel, who actually heads up Ways and Means, chairs that committee, said the president missed an opportunity to be bipartisan.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the Democrats see it as he proposed cuts to programs that they think are important. He proposed a health care plan that they think is going to erode that employer-based health care system. From Bush's point of view, he's saying, look, I'm proposing things that you can engage with me on, energy, health care. We may have different points of view, but let's at least get the conversation started. So it'll be interesting to see. You know, I mean, something may happen, nothing may happen, but it's going to be fun 2 years in Washington.
Deborah Solomon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Joins us from Washington, D.C. She's a reporter with The Wall Street Journal, who's been covering the budget. Annalise Anderson, a senior research fellow at Hoover and former associate director for economics and government with the U.S. Office of Management and Budget. Well, I guess the budget sets out pretty clear priorities, doesn't it, Annalise?
Well, I think it does, yes. It's interesting that the deficit in this budget and as projected in the future years is less than 2% of the gross domestic product. It's pretty low, in other words. So desperately seeking savings is not the mode that I think that the Congress ought to be in or the president. I think what we've got here are some big policy issues that are on the table that we need to look at, and how we solve them, whether we save a few bucks more or less, in terms of defense and Iraq and what we're going to do about the future of the healthcare system is not the important thing. So I think that some of the issues of looking at entitlements, healthcare, Medicare, Medicaid, are important issues. How we fund health insurance and what the incentives are, and what we do about the alternative minimum tax that, as Deborah says, is never included, but is there as a big source of revenue that isn't going to happen because it's adjusted every year as it should be. It should probably be adjusted and eliminated permanently. And other defense expenditures, these are all interesting factors that we ought to be taking a good look at.
Can the president, though, really balance this budget without raising taxes, in your judgment?
Well, with a little spending control on the part of Congress, sure. Why not?
And what do you see as the big battles? Defense, health care, deficit reduction, where are the biggest battles going to be?
I think the health care reduction is one of the big battles. I think it's one of the major issues on which we have to figure out in the future how we're going to handle increasing demand and how we're going to control the costs and whether we're going to get a system that encourages people to make more decisions themselves and helps, therefore, to reduce the growth in these expenditures without necessarily reducing what we get. You know, it takes away some of the perverse incentives. And I think the tax side, our tax system has been pretty much taxing about, in terms of the percentage of earnings, what it is now. And it looks like that is going to continue if these cuts are made permanent, the changes Bush made in the tax code. We still get more revenue every year. And we're doing so well economically. The story of this budget, the story of the Bush fiscal years, is that the economy has grown effectively, and we don't want to do anything to stop that happening. We seem to have a pretty good regime going right now. We might want to do some tweaks at the edges, but we don't want to dramatically change a tax structure that's going to suddenly put a brake on economic growth.
Would you say, though, Brad DeLong, that this 5% each year that's being projected by the White House is too rosy a summer?
It's a little high, especially, but 5% revenue growth is a little bit high if you don't have the alternative minimum tax fix. But you do have the alternative minimum tax fix. Everyone in Congress wants to do the alternative minimum tax fix. And that means it's extremely unlikely that you'll get anything near 5% revenue growth.
Can the president really keep Congress from raising taxes or increasing spending?
The president can do whatever he wants as long as he has 34 senators in his court and is willing to outlast the Congress when the political storm begins, right? I mean, Bill Clinton proved that in 1995. When he demonstrated that he was still fundamentally in control of the budget because he kept his people with him and Newt Gingrich couldn't keep his when they had their government shutdown confrontation.
What about just the whole negotiations that are likely to take place? I mean, how unified do you feel the Democrats are going to be?
They're not at all unified, right? They have lots of different goals and different expectations and conflicting views about the future. And I think it's nice that, so far at least, Democratic budget policy has been kind of fairly straight on the level. There haven't been the kind of magic asterisks we've seen elsewhere.
They're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place in many ways, though, the Democrats are, despite their majority.
Well, let me back up, right? I think that Annalisa was extremely misleading. On the one hand, in saying that with a little spending restraint, the budget can be balanced by 2012, and on the other hand saying less than 1 minute earlier that the AMT fix should be incorporated, should be made permanent, should be in there for planning purposes, but it isn't. The Bush administration has been doing this since 2000. I remember going down to Hoover then and telling that the Bush administration to be had either to decide whether it was going to fix the AMT and thus give people the tax cuts that it said it was going to give them, or keep the AMT in operation and thus take back with their left hand a huge chunk of what they were giving with their right in terms of tax cuts. You know, to say that the administration has a proposal for balance in 2012 and that the AMT should be fixed, but it doesn't plan on getting the revenue that the AMT fix would cost. Well, you know, everyone's entitled to their opinion on the budget. Everyone's not entitled to their own facts. And the fact is that if you have the AMT fix in the federal budget, in your budget planning, and if you have likely additional defense costs of our engagement in the Middle East in the document, the Bush budget doesn't achieve balance by 2012. And nobody who regards, or nobody who is doing budget planning as opposed to propaganda, should say that it does.
Brad Along again is professor of economics at UC Berkeley, also research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research, and was deputy assistant secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy, 93 to 95. Annalise Anderson, you want to respond to what you just heard from Brad Along?
Well, I agree that not everything in the Bush that will happen is expressed in these budget numbers. And I do think my own judgment is that the alternative minimum tax is a difficult policy matter that always gets in the way of creating better tax policy, and that this budget is a little bit optimistic in terms of what may actually happen. I'm not sure it's overextended in terms of what may happen in terms of expenditures for the war in Iraq. But I think that when you're at less than 2% of gross domestic product, or closer to 1.5% in terms of a deficit, that you cannot predict revenues quite accurately. Revenues have been stronger than we expect. I think that a deficit, if we end up in a couple of years with a deficit of 2% of GDP, I don't think that that's a disaster. I think when we get close, in this political environment, with Congress feeling that the best thing that they can do for people is to spend their money on domestic programs, and the more you give Congress, the more they spend. And Congress is always going to run a deficit because it is always going to spend more money than is available. And so the idea that we could possibly balance the budget is likely to be untrue. You raise taxes to give Congress enough money to balance the budget, and they will raise spending so it is not balanced.
Brad DeLong, you wanted in here, yeah?
Were you in this country in 1998, 99, and 2000? We had a procedural regime governing Congress's spending that did produce substantial surpluses, that even got the non-Social Security part of the budget into surplus? I mean, to say that Congress will always run a deficit, and that's a fact of nature, kind of forgets the fact that there was a decade before 2001.
I think it's hardly a decade.
The 1990s saw enormous progress in reducing the deficit.
Well, there progress in not reducing the deficit. We've had substantial progress in reducing the deficit under the Bush administration.
No, the Clinton
Bush administration
now is
the Clinton administration managed to cut spending, overall spending, because it reduced by, in real terms, defense spending 35% to 40% from 6.2% of GDP to 3% of GDP. And so it really cut what we were spending in terms of our national economy in half. And that was where we were in 2/11, when 2/11 occurred, 9/11 occurred. And we have had a moderate increase in defense spending. The numbers seem huge, but we're at a little over 4% of GDP instead of 6% at the Reagan buildup that was so effective in deterring the Soviet Union.
Let me just shift. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Brad.
The annual deficit now is $500 billion a year worse than in the end of the Clinton administration, because we're spending $150 billion a year more on defense now than we were planning to spend in 2000. $150 billion is a lot less than $500 billion.
I'm wondering about, there's just so many things in this budget. I'm glad we've come to this crossroads here in terms of the debate, but what about all these legislative earmarks? I mean, the president spoke about them in his State of the Union address. There are 13,000 of them. He's talking about wanting a line item veto, just like we heard from Reagan when he was president. And I don't think it's going to happen, we could safely assume. But what's going to happen to the earmarks? Anybody want to speculate on that?
Well, I suspect that they're going to stay. Because, you see, for each individual congressman, to have an earmark is a plus, not a minus. Right, you go to, you know, say downtown Boise, and you say, here, this is an official document telling about earmarks for their districts gotten into individual House bills by individual House members, and here I am, Congressman from Idaho, and here I got this into the budget, and this official document says that this is a special redirection of federal money for the benefit of my constituents. That's not likely to lose any individual congressman votes. So attempts to make earmarks more public, I don't think they're going to diminish the number of earmarks. Right? Earmarks as a whole disrupt the budget process and drive the executive agencies, OMB and the Treasury and so forth, up the wall. But they're part of the way that congressmen signal that they care about their districts and that congressmen actually get resources for people in their districts.
We're coming up rapidly on a break here. I want to get your response, though, Annalise. Yeah?
Well, I would hope that we can do something about earmarks, but it seems to just enormously expand along with the consultants on K Street. So I don't know what we're going to do about a budget that is a Congress and a budget that is so eager to get money, and spend it. This is a difficult problem. It is.
Let us find out what our listeners think. In fact, we invite you to join us, and you can do that now if you have questions or comments about the proposed budget. We're talking about President Bush's proposed 2008 budget of $2.9 trillion for the budget year that begins October 1st. And if you have something you'd like to contribute here, by all means do. It's live, and we welcome your phone calls. You can join us now toll-free at 866-733-6786. Again, our toll-free number for your calls from wherever you're listening to us or however, on the radio, the Internet, or the Sirius satellite. It's 866-733-6786. Or you can email us. The email address here is forum@kqed.org. Talking with Annalise Anderson of the Hoover Institution and with Brad DeLong of UC Berkeley, professor of economics there. I spoke earlier with Deborah Solomon of the Wall Street Journal, and we'll talk with Ed Epstein of the Chronicle as well, and your calls and emails when we return on Forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about President Bush's proposed federal budget plan and anticipated congressional response and trying to break it down and reconstruct it for you, deconstruct it for you. In fact, there's been some mentioning of the ATM, and I'm sorry to say that we should have probably mentioned to listeners who wondered, what is the ATM? The AMT. The ATM is where you get money. The AMT is at the bank. The AMT is the alternative minimum tax, and that's a levy essentially aimed at the wealthy that increasingly has been said to hit middle-class taxpayers. We're talking with economist Brad DeLong and economist Annalise Anderson. And I wanted to get Ed Epstein in on this conversation. And Ed Epstein Chris has been covering the budget for the Chronicle, as well as the political things going on in Washington there with respect to the budget. He's Washington correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle. Good morning, Ed.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, glad to have you. What are you reading there in terms of just a general response to the budget?
Well, the Democrats, of course, are very critical. New in the majority, they want to sit down their markers. And I think they're helped in that, the fact that their main spokesman on the budget is Representative John Spratt. And the House side is Representative John Spratt from South Carolina, a moderate type Democrat who can bore you to tears with his wonkish reeling off of numbers about the budget. And he's a deficit hawk. And then on the Senate side, it's the Budget Committee Chairman is Kent Conrad from North Dakota, who's also been a big deficit hawk. So those are the two main Democratic spokesmen. They criticize the president's rosy assumptions in this budget. They say his projection of a surplus by 2012 is way off base. They say, for instance, that if you're going to do away with the alternative minimum tax, it will cost the government, I believe it's $1 trillion over so many years. That's just one example of what they say is an overly optimistic forecast on his part.
You mentioned in your article that for California, there are both benefits and problems in this budget, that it would mean millions of dollars, for example, for national parks. But again, the president's eliminating money that would reimburse this state, or any other state for that matter, for jailing illegal immigrants.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's tried to eliminate that program every year. He's been in office, I believe. So it would be going on 7 years now, and it has never been eliminated because members from California, Texas, and Arizona in particular object to it, eliminating this program under which the states are reimbursed for the cost of jailing illegal immigrants. States say, why should we pay for people who shouldn't be here in the first place? But the money has been cut, just the program has not been eliminated.
Is there some protest within the ranks of the Republican Party where this budget is concerned? I mean, you've got people like Chuck Hagel, for example, who are against the surge money for the war, big bump in terms of defense spending. Are we seeing some of the president's own GOP going in other ways?
Well, this goes deeper than just the budget. It's the whole theory of what the Republican Party should be standing for now after its loss last November, because the Republicans became, let's face it, under the Bush years, they became the spend-and-spend party, where they used to be small government. Republicanism was, you know, let's get government out of people's hair. But under President Bush, we've witnessed tremendous expansions of government spending, government power. The No Child Left Behind Act basically made the president the president of every school board in America. We've seen, because of the 9/11 attacks and then the war in Iraq, a tremendous increase in spending on Homeland Security and on the military. And we saw, you mentioned before, the earmark explosion, which came in the Republican Congress. In the 1980s, President Reagan vetoed an appropriations bill because it contained just a few hundred earmarks. Now there's, like, what was it last year, 13,000 of these tucked away in bills. It's probably more an underlying bill that we don't even know about. So the Republicans are having a basic debate about what they should stand for. And they reelected their leaders in the House, John Boehner and Roy Blunt. There was an effort from the Republican Study Group, which is the most conservative small government Republicans. They have Congressman Mike Pence of Indiana elected leader, but he lost rather heavily in their leadership election.
One of the things that's been tucked away, to use your phrase, Ed, in this whole budget is introducing means testing for entitlements.
Well, for the richest Americans, for Medicare, that's one of Bush's ideas, to just cut the rate of increase in Medicare, which is by, you know, this huge unfunded liability of trillions and trillions of dollars as the baby boomers start to retire. So that's his, you know, it's only, there's different figures if you look at a 5-year time frame or a 10-year time frame. It's only like $100 billion. In cuts, which amount to a very small decrease in the rate of increase of Medicare spending. And the president's budget director, Rob Portman, on Monday when he unveiled this, was at great pains to say, you know, we're not making absolute cuts in Medicare. We're just trying to make some slight reductions in the increase in spending in Medicare.
What about what Jed Gregg said, who's a Republican, that he praised the whole budget but said baby boomers are not being taken into account enough? There's been a major demographic shift, and the numbers don't add up.
Well, that's certainly true, and if you look at Social Security or Medicare, should scare all of us. Of course, the president's proposal was to set up private Social Security accounts, which the Democratic Congress, particularly Nancy Pelosi, give her credit, she very skillfully set out 2 years ago to scuttle that plan, to make Bush appear as an enemy of Social Security, and use that as a lever to really go after the Republican control of Congress. And she succeeded in doing that. They talk about more mild changes to the system, but face it, we're all going to live a long, long time. And I mean, my mother's 87, and she's in pretty good health. And you know, today's baby boomers, the life expectancy continues to grow, and we're all afraid to ask the basic question: is do we want people, if you're going to live to be 90 or 100, do we want people to still be retiring at age 66, or where we raise it to now 67? So they'll be sitting around playing shuffleboard for 25, 30 years, and who's going to pay for that? So we may have to rethink the whole system of retirement.
Ed Epstein, again with us from the nation's capital's Washington correspondent with the San Francisco Chronicle. Want to stay with us, Ed, for the rest of the hour?
Yes, I'd be glad to.
Great, and because we're going to go to our callers, and we'll go to our state capital, Sacramento. Douglas, good morning.
Oh, good morning. Yeah, my question, I actually work for the state of California. Sorry about that. And I've also worked in county mental health. And what I've found to be the case is that they love in Washington, Republicans and Democrats alike, to talk about how they can reduce their federal spending or et cetera and save the country money. And then that usually means that deficits go up in the state of California or any other state because there are things that have to be paid for, like prisons and health care, et cetera. And then they, of course, struggle, so then that falls to county and city governments. We're down to, I think, 6 counties that support hospitals for the so-called safety net. So I really wonder what the respondents would like to say about the impacts of this continual ignoring of the real public needs. And because usually what I'm hearing, and I'm hearing on this program today, is talk about special programs like bridges with congressmen's names on them and so on, but the real costs and the real needs are not really being debated, and that's very concerning to me.
You want to address the concerns that we're hearing here, Brad DeLong, from Douglas?
He's put his finger on a big problem with our system of government, which is that we have federalism, and we like federalism because it means that a lot of decisions that ought to be made at the local level can be made and financed at the local and at the state level, and that not everything has to go up to the federal level, and you can take account of differences in state voter preferences and in state conditions. On the other hand, you then have this permanent game by which, you know, the feds want to lower taxes and say, oh, it's the state's fault that now you're not getting these services anymore, or the state wants to avoid raising its taxes and says, oh, it's the federal's fault that they're no longer funding this. And this is a standard kind of hemming and hawing that goes on in the U.S. government. And I think it's going on more than usually in this decade, that the conflicts between states and feds, right, with each attempting to blame the other for what's not being provided, is a bit sharper than it used to be. I don't really understand why.
You see things that way, Annalise Anderson?
Well, I agree that there's this sort of continual tension with the federalism, and we do want federalism. We do want to say we make these decisions here, or we do this at the state level, not the federal level. We do this at the local level, and we used to feel quite strongly about that way about education. Why should we be taxing around the country to pay for police? Isn't that a local function? You know, shouldn't we be funding our own schools and potholes and so forth, and transportation systems even? And so we do have this conflict. It's true. I don't know if it's getting worse. It seems that we believe that if we can get money from the federal government that somehow we don't have to pay for it ourselves. But there's only one set of taxpayers out there. You know, we can't get sort of money from Washington that is not ultimately from ourselves. We may move it around a little bit, but ultimately it's a question of what we think the federal government ought to do and not do.
Let me move around a little bit to more of your calls. And Ashok is next from Oakland. Thank you for waiting. You're on Forum. Good morning.
Hi, Michael. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The question that I have to the panelists is there's always a discussion about reducing the deficit, and I always find it amusing that we don't talk about the real big question, which is the enormous size of the debt. I mean, to me, it seems like somebody with a $10,000 credit card debt is proud of themselves because they're saying that they're only going to see that $10,000 gain by 1% or 2% every year. And, you know, in an individual financial context, that would be ludicrous. But it seems like we're content to think that that's a completely appropriate way for the federal government to operate. And I'm just curious what people think about this generally and why there isn't any traction to pay down the debt. I mean, it can be done. Countries like Australia, for example, recently paid down their debt completely. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, thank you. Also, kind of dovetailing an email from a listener named Sean who says, I want to point out the obvious. The Bush administration came in with a Clinton balanced budget and surplus, sort of alluded to before by Brad DeLong. Given his big government, no tax and spend philosophy, I find Bush's sudden balanced budget interest duplicitous. You want to comment on this, Annalise Anderson?
Well, I think that, as I pointed out before, the Clinton administration balanced the budget on the backs of defense, and it decreased real defense spending 35% to 40% and left it at 3% of gross domestic product. That was just before 9/11. And so there has to be some response to that. The budget is still much lower than it was when Clinton started office in terms of relation to GDP. You've got to measure it in relation to something or other. And so I think what the Bush administration did do and what Clinton had already done is increase domestic spending. And the Bush administration has maintained fairly high domestic spending. And we should under no circumstances think that this domestic budget is starved. It is not starved. We are spending a lot of money. We have a lot of demands. We have a lot of commitments. But we're spending a lot of money. And so relatively, we're not spending nearly as much on defense. We're spending only two-thirds on defense, even including the Iraq War, that the Reagan administration spent. And so, you know, to call this duplicitous and to look back and think that the Clinton administration was just great because it balanced the budget by dramatically cutting defense, I don't think it's such a great thing to look back on.
Now, here's another listener, and Brad DeLong will get a response from you, but he talks about, this is Piet in San Jose, who says,
owl flag here.
The Department of Defense, this listener writes, is not entitled to a percentage of GNP. Just because the country's businesses make more money does not mean the greedy DOD, that is Department of Defense, must pay Halliburton more than the going bargain rate of $700 for a hammer. That probably expresses a good deal of the anger at the high budgetary allocation for defense or for the war effort, but I suppose you see the picture very differently than Annalise
does. No, I don't see the picture very differently. The picture is very different. I know it's the talking point out of White House communications that Clinton balanced the budget by cutting defense, and that the reason that we're not in the same situation the Clinton administration was is because we're actually spending money on defense that we ought to. But a $150 billion increase in the annual defense budget does not account for a $500 billion swing in the annual deficit. And people who are interested in informing their listeners, rather than in mindlessly repeating White House talking points, simply shouldn't say that.
Did you want to respond, Annalise Anderson?
Well, I think the changes in defense may not entirely account for. There may be increases in domestic spending as well. I agree with that, and I think the Bush administration has spent more domestically than I would have preferred that it spend. I think they ought to have gotten some spending control there earlier.
We'll get more of your calls on. Gary, morning, you're on.
Hello.
Hi.
For taking my call.
Yes.
My comment is that what's wrong with America today is, like these people, this woman that's on here defending the Bush budget, she believes it. There's certain things that are going on in this country that aren't ever put out by the White House, and therefore they're not talked about by people that are responsible financial people, such as the $800 billion that the veterans of this Iraq war are going to take and cost us over the future because of their rehabilitation and all sorts of other things as a result of being damaged and losing limbs and having, you know, head wounds and things like that. Where's this $800 billion mentioned anywhere? When you want to take and defend a White House statement such as the budget, you need to look carefully at all the things that aren't being mentioned, that aren't put out to the press, that Mr. Bush is going to plop in the laps of the next president.
Let me ask you, Ed Epstein, to respond to, I think, the pith of what Gary's raising here, that is how this budget, which is projecting toward the future, toward 2012, and toward really shrinking the deficit and all, and having a surplus, is really taking into account all of these kind of hidden costs that he's bringing up, such as veterans and so forth.
Well, I don't think that cost is particularly hidden. I'm sure it's in the projections of what it's going to cost us. These people are going to go on, if you're disabled, you'll go on disability, and it will be part of the costs of the actuaries' figure for these programs.
Well, but it's hidden to the extent that we don't know how long this war is going to drag
right.
on and the,
well,
the effects of this war.
The argument over how the president has chosen the budget for the war up to this time through special appropriations, but this time he included the $100 billion upcoming supplemental for the war and the estimated $145 billion for the coming fiscal year in the regular budget in response to demands from Democrats who said that this supplemental appropriations process did not allow them, the Congress, the time to do a thorough examination of how the money was being spent and what it was going for.
Let me thank the caller. I want to move on to more of your calls. We'll go to Los Altos. Richard, you're on.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
You know, there are a lot of us who are fiscal conservatives who are really trying to understand what's going on because, you know, when Ronald Reagan came in, our deficit was, the debt was less than $1 trillion. And he tripled it. And his successor added another trillion, and now we've got $3 trillion in the last 6 years. So the so-called tax cut seems to be a debt that's being dumped onto our children and grandchildren and those yet unborn. You know, I just would like to know how they really rationalize this. You know, as being so-called, you know, the so-called fiscal conservative party.
I think this is to you, Annalise Anderson.
Well, I think that, unfortunately, the political situation is such that if you really tried to balance the budget without having some strict legislation, possibly constitutional, that limited both taxes and spending, that you're going to spend everything the government takes in and more. If you raise taxes so you get a little more revenue, you'll spend more. And I think that that is the unfortunate dynamic that exists. Therefore, you have to run deficits, and you run them continually. In fact, the debt, which is the total amount that's owed, as a relation to the gross domestic product, has been declining under Bush. And it can continue to decline even while the absolute number goes up. And so I don't see that this is an unsustainable problem. I think the unsustainable issue is what you're going to do about entitlements, both Social Security and especially Medicare, with the baby boomers. That's one big one. And a lesser amount of spending is defense and the question of what we really ought to be doing on our base defense budget and weakening the Department of Defense, whether we need to look more radically at things or more creatively out of the box at things like what's happening with nuclear weapons. nuclear proliferation? Do we need missile defense to take care of situations in North Korea and maybe Iran? And so we're not thinking about any of those things. We're, you know, thinking narrowly.
Since the conservative fiscal response has always been to lay a good deal of emphasis on domestic programs, I should mention here, just for the record, that the president's proposed eliminating or sharply reducing 141 federal programs, and Congress will probably ignore this. This is to the tune of about $12 billion. The president has called on Congress before to do exactly this, and I think it's fairly safe to say that it's not going to fly with the Democratic Congress particularly. We're talking, if you've just joined us, about the federal budget plan and talking also about anticipated congressional response as well. Brad DeLong with us, professor of economics at UC Berkeley, Annalise Anderson, who is senior research fellow at the Hoover Institution. We spoke earlier with Deborah Solomon, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and Ed Epstein is with us now, who's Washington correspondent with the San Francisco Chronicle. If you're listening to us on Sirius, we will continue to broadcast with you and continue to take calls. If you're with us from KQED or KQEI in Sacramento, it's time for you to pony up and join us in terms of pledging. I'm Michael Krasny on KQED. Let me go to more calls. We go next to a caller in Oakland. Tom, morning.
Good morning, Michael. Thank you for taking the call. Two comments. Number one is on earmarking. The assumption of the one commentator earlier was that, you know, earmarking is a good thing. I think the reality is everybody likes something for nothing, but earmarking is something where they take 100% of your money, take 10% of it for administration, and give you back 90%. And I'd like to just go on record as saying this is one voter who's against it, and my politicians do not get points for earmarking.
All right.
In my world.
We have heard that opinion. And Annalise Anderson, you want to respond?
I basically agree with that. I think we ought to get rid of earmarks altogether.
And Brad DeLong.
Thank him very much. If we had a lot of voters like him, we would probably have a better government and would certainly deserve a better one.
Well, we'll thank the caller and move on to more of your calls. We go next to Jan in Sacramento. Good morning. Jan, are you there?
Oh, yes.
Hi.
First comment, the war that Bush got us into, which has irreparably harmed this country as well as destroyed Iraq, with that money, we could have shored up Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, for the foreseeable future, and I'd like the speakers to give me exact numbers on that. The other point is that any budget fix always hits the wage-earning middle class, and instead of, I don't see anything in Bush's budget about removing subsidies from big oil. I don't see anything about removing subsidies from big agriculture, not small farms, but big agriculture. The tax system, the tax cuts benefited the top 1%, and the top 1% have more in assets than the bottom 90%, the top 10%. So wealth inequality is at its worst since pre-Depression, and if we go into Iran, which from what I read, the president is secretly planning to do, the economic results would be disastrous, not to mention the we might even escalate to nuclear war. The other point I want to make is it's always a tax fix that is proposed for the working middle class, and that does not work for the simple reason that working people, ordinary working people, do not have the money to set aside into something like medical savings accounts. So this budget is so anti-human. And unless we invest in human beings, it will cost us more in the long run. This cuts programs for children. We're going to pay for it later when these children become sick and unproductive.
Thank you for the call. Ed Epstein, there again is some prognosticating about the future effects and consequences of this budget, and the sentiments that we heard from that caller probably are a lot of what we're hearing from the Democratic side. Huh?
Yes, similar thoughts, but I just want to correct a few things. You know, the House did pass this bill one of Pelosi's early bills to cut $14 billion in tax breaks for oil and gas. And the president's budget contained a cuts of a few billion dollars, eliminating tax breaks for oil and gas companies. And as far as farm subsidies go, because corn and soybean prices are at record highs, the government is paying out billions of dollars a year less each year in subsidies to farmers. So these programs, there are changes afoot in those areas.
One thing positive in this budget that I think we need to call attention to, in line with what the caller might deem more humanitarian kinds of actions, is more for low-income college students.
The president proposed an increase in Pell Grants, but he proposed eliminating other education loan programs, the Perkins loans and things. So the Democrats say he was not exactly telling the truth when he trumpeted that he supported their plan to increase the Pell Grant limits.
Is the president not really, just from your perch, Ed, not taking into account the political environment he's got and his low polls and being lame duck and all that?
Well, no, I think he's very aware of that. He went last weekend to Williamsburg, Virginia, where the House Democrats had their annual legislative retreat, and he was quite conciliatory. He emphasized areas that he hoped they could work together with them, energy independence, energy efficiency, No Child Left Behind, immigration. He laid out his position on the Iraq War, of course, which is a huge difference he has with the Democrats. And they received him courteously, if not very enthusiastically. And I think both sides have a need to accomplish something in the next 2 years.
Well, we will watch what that will be. I want to extend my thanks to you, Ed Epstein, to Deborah Solomon from the Wall Street Journal. Ed Epstein's with the Chronicle. Annalise Anderson of Hoover Institution and Brad DeLong of UC Berkeley. Thanks to all our listeners. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.